I have a little machine about a little smaller than that one, and I'm terrified of it.
Yeah, do you use the mini discs?
No, this the one I have is just records onto the whatever it is in there. I don't know.
Okay, I think we're fine.
Okay.
All right, so we will just keep going, and I will take this out. All right, so if you could, let's start with some actual family history. When did your father's family, where did your father come from?
He came from a small, well, he was born in New York. He was born on 2nd Avenue and 8th Street, something down there. It wasn't really the Lower East Side, but it was down in that direction. We know the house. We found it, you know, so... I have pictures of it I could show you. In fact, we have a family website, and it's on there. I think it's on there. Mm-hmm. But his parents had come over very recently, and I guess his father, my grandfather, came in about 1901, 1902, one of those 2 years.
From
Probuzhna, Ukraine, which at that time was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, so they didn't think of it as Ukraine. But he came to this little town. I've been there. It's amazing. It's amazingly awful. But apparently it had seen better days, but not much. But he and his brother came together, and it was a huge family, and most of them stayed home. And a few went to Israel in the 20s, and the others died and were all killed. Everybody was killed by the Germans. So, but my grandfather and his brother arrived, and they had been butchers back home. And, oh, they were very young, like 18 or 20. And so they set up a butcher shop, and that's what they did. And my grandmother, I guess, had already been selected to be my grandfather's wife. Whether they knew each other or whether it was arranged, I have no idea. But she came a few years later with her mother. She was younger. And so then my father was born in 1910. She was only 18 at the time, so she'd been here about 3 years, two or three years.
Okay. And can you characterize their sort of political involvement at that point?
Grandparents?
Yeah.
None. No. They didn't speak English. Mm-hmm. They were mainly concerned, you know, with just making it in the United States. And
what do you know about his childhood?
Well... they had moved to the Bronx by that time. I think he grew up there, and I know they didn't speak English at home, and he was the oldest of four kids, and they just adored him. And he told funny stories that, for example, his mother decided, or his parents decided, he should learn to play the violin. So he actually did play the violin. He learned something, but they hired a gypsy to come teach him. And so they would go into a closed room, and the gypsy would do all the playing. My father never did any of it. The gypsy would play for an hour, and then my grandparents were thrilled with the progress that my father was making. He couldn't play anything, but that ruse went on for quite a while. Everybody was happy. So then, but he didn't say much more about it. You know, he went to DeWitt Clinton High School, and he graduated when he was about 14, and went to Columbia, and, family legend was, I mean, what I got from my mother and so was that, you know, he finished Columbia, brilliant student, and then was denied admittance to Columbia Medical School because he was Jewish. But I don't think this is true because, I mean, he probably denied it there, but I've seen his transcript and it was horrible, so he couldn't possibly, you know, and he hadn't taken any science courses or hardly any, so I could
what
see
what. Did he do?
Well, he took German literature. Actually, you know, he never told us that, and we never knew that. I only found that out from my uncle recently. He's recently being, you know, since my father died, but he was so upset by the war that he never mentioned ever to us that he had studied German literature in college.
Huh.
But he did. He had a lot of it. And he also had, you know, a little bit of the science here and there, but it was a really spotty kind of record with lots of C's. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, he didn't get medical school. But then he took a year. He went to Harvard for a year of sort of catch up to take science courses and so on. And then he did well enough to get into medical school. So.
And by what age was he when he went to Harvard?
He's probably at 20.
Okay. Yeah. And so there hadn't really been any previous medical or scientific?
Oh, no, absolutely not. Okay. No, nothing.
Okay. And what about your mother? What at what point in that story did they meet?
See, he was a medical student, I guess, and so he was in his mid-20s, I guess, and she was a student, college student at NYU. Mm-hmm. And they met at some party.
So there's no meeting story. And her, yeah. And her family history was, can you just sort of give me a
similar, time? Well, similar and very different. Her mother was born in the United States. That's the only one of my grandparents who was. Mm-hmm. But her parents had just come over, so that was, again, an immigrant family. And that was a fairly large family, and they ran a store on the Lower East Side. And my grandfather, on my mother's side, came from a place that's now, I've also visited that, it's near Košice in Slovakia. Mm-hmm. And he was of a much larger family, even 7 or 8 kids, and they all came over. He was about 5. Mm-hmm. And somehow they met. I know how they met. That was interesting, because they were both radicals, and they went to some poetry. They met at a poetry hearing, and they were at a poetry hearing, and then they met later and realized they'd both been there, and so it was they said it was Edwin Markham's Man with a Hoe. That was the poem. It's a great radical rousing poem. And,
yes. Yeah. And by radical, you mean?
Yeah. Left wing. Yeah.
And what kinds of issues?
Whatever they were, they mm-hmm. were. I mean, they were out there with flags for everything, with the banners. But my great grandmother, she was a suffragette, and so the whole family, they were all active in women's rights issues, but also on radical politics.
And your mother then,
yeah,
as a What was her educational, like, how far did she go?
She went through college. She graduated college. Mm-hmm. And NYU.
And where?
NYU. And it was English with a minor in theater, or theater with a minor in English, but, you know, that.
So, and not science.
No, right?
Okay.
No.
And so to what extent did she take an interest in your father's scientific work when that began? So that was very separate for them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, she always claimed she was too stupid to understand it. You know, she put on this pose of this. It was really a pose, but
yes, right, right. Okay, tell me about Hebrew school, etc. There's this story that your father is a Talmudic scholar, etc.
So wasn't.
What kind of?
It's hard to say because my mother always said that my father's family was religious and that they always went to synagogue and so on. And my uncle, my father's brother, says no, they never did, and that there was none of that. And I gather, but even back in the old country, they hadn't been very religious. There had been a lot of religious people in this small mm-hmm. shtetl, but mm-hmm. they were not terribly religious. But one of the stories is that, you know, they had, the men having to wear this little yarmulke, that they kept it in their pocket when they passed the rabbi's house. They stick it on their head, and so that if he was looking out the window, they'd see that they had the hat on, but they weren't seriously mm-hmm. religious. But nevertheless, he did get, because it was a cultural thing, that's the kind of world that he was in, he got some of that. And I think he was bar mitzvah and all that. But he wasn't a Talmudic scholar, except that he was interested in all this. So he Jewish history was one of his passions. And Talmud only insofar as it was part of the cultural mm-hmm. Movement. If he could, I mean, the movement of Judaism that interested him really deeply was the one that's called Reconstructionism, which at the time when it began, it's changed a lot now, but when it began, it was an attempt to consider it just as a culture. And to use the books and even the religious texts and so on as cultural texts rather mm-hmm. than as mm-hmm. Religious ones. Mm-hmm. So he wasn't a Talmudic scholar in the sense of having been trained as one, but he was one in the sense that he was interested.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's actually good clarification. Yeah. Okay, at what point? Let's see. So now we are in med school. Mm-hmm. And at what point do you think he begins to think of himself, did he practice at all?
No, not that.
At what point does he begin to see himself as a researcher?
Not until he was in Lexington. He joined after medical school. I don't know quite where he had his internship, but anyway, pretty soon he was in the Civilian Conservation Corps. And that, as a doctor, that was part of the public health service mm-hmm. wing. So he was in that. And he was in that because he didn't want to practice. And he didn't want to practice because he believed in socialized medicine, and he didn't want private practice. Mm-hmm. And so he joined that, and they sent him to Lexington. And it was after he got there that he became interested in the problem of addiction. Mm-hmm. And that's, he wasn't thinking of himself, I think, as a scientist at all until then, or as a researcher. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But they had set up the research unit. It was very small, and they invited him to join it, and he did. And that was the rest of his life was spent there.
Okay. So let's talk a bit about this belief in socialized medicine, mm-hmm. and where you think he got that and why it was strong enough to sort of direct the course of his life.
Well, he, I'll see if it's hard to explain that so clearly. I mean, it was part of his political outlook. Mm-hmm. He wasn't as radical as my mother, but he did believe in what he considered a just society, and that included everybody having health care and that they shouldn't have to pay exorbitant things for it. And he also didn't, he thought of medicine as a service and not as something that one should get rich off of. Mm-hmm. And neither of my parents had any interest in money whatsoever, ever. And he just felt it was important to have enough to live on and raise your kids, but not to mm-hmm. not to get rich. So they deliberately chose not to raise, to become wealthy.
And you think that the decision to go to Lexington, to what extent did your mother sort of participate in that decision?
I think if she had, that was fine, mm-hmm. As far as I know. Yeah. But her role becomes a little murkier later, so.
All right. So prior to going to Lexington then, how would you characterize, was there any interest in addiction, any social contact with people who were addicted?
No.
Nothing
I'm
at
sure,
all?
I'm sure, absolutely nothing.
Yes.
I mean, if there may have been, but if so, I never heard about it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this was a family where there were, people talked. I mean, my parents talked in front of us about everything.
Yes.
Just about.
Yes.
So.
Did he or they drink or smoke?
No. Well, smoke. He smoked.
He smoked.
Yeah. She smoked socially, but he smoked. I never remember him without smoking. He was always smoking.
Yes.
Killed him in the end. Yeah.
It's so funny how many people tell me about smoking at Lexington. Yeah. It wasn't just a recreational activity, you know, it was a professional activity. At what point do you think he started to smoke?
I don't have any idea when he
started. I mean, it was
I just don't know. That's just what they did. And don't forget, that's the heart of tobacco country.
Yeah, absolutely.
In Lexington. So if he hadn't smoked before, he certainly would have learned right away.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. All right. So now at that point, I want to do the linguistic thing. Okay. He's speaking, obviously, English, but he's also still speaking?
He spoke Yiddish all his life.
Yiddish. Okay. Yeah. So they, yeah. And did your parents speak it in the home?
No, my mother didn't know Yiddish.
Uh-huh. Okay.
She didn't know any. Just a few swear words, I guess, but not. And her parents didn't either. Mm-hmm. I mean, they may have known it, but they didn't use it, and they were adamant about not speaking Yiddish. Hmm. And whereas my father, when I was in college, I wanted to learn it. They were teaching it, and he had a fit, and he said, "It's dead. Don't even think about that. If you want to learn Hebrew, do that, but don't learn Yiddish. You're wasting your time." And so, you know, I did whatever he told me in those days, so I didn't do it, didn't learn it. And he may have been right, I don't know, but in any case, but he spoke it, and he used it when he traveled. He used it all over the world, mm-hmm. and this was really an international language for him. And mm-hmm. he met people everywhere. Just he'd go into a park, you know, in Moscow or somewhere else, and just sit down and, you know, start talking to people, and he'd find people who spoke Yiddish, and mm-hmm. They'd strike up conversations. And he said it always went very well until they found out that he was a doctor, and then they start talking about their aches and the pains. And then he, after he got sick of that, he would explain to them he was a psychiatrist, and then they would.
All right, so let's talk about that identity formation.
Yeah.
How he becomes a psychiatrist, how he thinks about psychiatry, sort of prior to going to Lexington, and also tell me the story about the analysis, his relationship.
Well, that was a little later. I don't know how he decided to become a psychiatrist. I have really no idea how he chose that as opposed to some other specialty. It certainly wasn't something the Civilian Conservation Corps expected him.
Yeah.
But
knowing him,
yeah.
Do you think he did choose it deliberately, or do you think that it was more that it somehow became, you said the internship or residency wasn't kind of clear.
Not to me. That may have been it. I mean, it may have been just that this was open and this looked interesting, and so we did it, you know, rather than sitting down saying, well, which one should I, what should I become? I don't think he had any clear career goals early on. And, you know, his idea of a doctor was a doctor, basically. I mean, you fix people. And even as a child, I remember he always had carried with him everywhere he went a little black bag of medical equipment, and always in the car. And, you know, and I asked him, why do you take that everywhere? And he says, because if I ever come across someone who needs me, I have to be there for them. And once we did pass by a car accident, he was out of the car instantly with all these things. And,
like my grandfather.
Well, your grandfather?
Who was also the son of a butcher.
Oh.
And my father also, my father and sister are both physicians as well. And my grandfather always carried a little black bag in the back seat.
Yeah.
Precisely for the same thing. Although I don't remember it ever actually happening. Okay, so psychiatry is at that point, what does it mean to him?
I can't say. You know, okay. I was just a little baby. I don't remember.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Yeah. And so the analysis takes place later.
Analysis was later. When he'd been at Lexington for how many years? I don't know. I must have been, by the time I must have been about 8 or something like that, maybe 9.
You were born in what?
I was born in St. Louis, which was the conservation corps place. And then when I was, by the time I was 1, I was in Lexington. And Norma, Dan, and Jean were all born in Lexington. Somewhere along in there, he decided to leave the Public Health Service. I didn't mention that in that article. He decided to leave and go into private practice as a psychoanalyst. And I have never been able to figure this out. And it was really strange because it was totally conflicting with his beliefs. Whether my mother pushed him or whether his parents were pushing him, I don't know, but I'm absolutely sure it wasn't his idea. Probably my mother, probably both of them, I don't know. But anyway, he decided to go into private psychoanalytic practice. But he also believed that in order to do that, he had to be analyzed himself. Mm-hmm. And so he was going to Cincinnati to some analyst there. And we left Narco for a year. We moved into town, and he had an office. And I remember that very well. And it had, you know, I remember the furniture and the secretary, and you know, I thought it was quite nice that he had that. And you know, I went over there a few times and saw it. But then he had a nervous breakdown. What they called a nervous breakdown those days. We had no idea. He went to a terrible depression, and his colleagues at Narco. I guess his resignation had not gone through, so they blocked it. So that he, and they.
So who would have done that? Isbell or?
Probably was Isbell, yeah. Fraser. And so they, or maybe it was, I don't remember who else it might have been in those days, but whoever was in charge, they blocked his resignation. And that made him eligible for Public Health Service medical care. And he was in the hospital in Bethesda, Maryland for a year. And treated for depression. And then when he came back out, we were still in town then. And when he came back out, we moved back out to Narco.
And this was happening when you were 8 years old.
I was 9 by the when that was nine
eight
the year.
Nine.
Maybe I was 10 that year that he was I was 10 the year that he was in Bethesda. Yeah.
Hospitalized for a year.
Yeah, yeah. Because it was before antidepressant
yes,
drugs and. This was a whole year, yeah. So then so that year would have been, the 1949. And we would like to get the records. My brother and I would really like to understand this. We have never been, my mother is just impossible to discuss it with her. She claims not to know.
What must that have been like for her?
Well, difficult. Yeah.
She has 4 kids.
She has 4 kids.
In Lexington, in town. And it's pretty unclear what he's going to do.
Whether he's
going
to ever come back. They didn't know, you know, no idea.
Wow.
So, yeah, no, that was difficult for her.
And that was, okay, so after he's gone through psychoanalysis himself,
yeah.
This episode occurs. And so when does he come back to Narco?
Well, right 50. After that, when he comes about 1950, yeah.
Okay.
And so then is when we lived that little red brick house, and I think it was really after that that he really began to do his best work. I mean, mm-hmm. it was, you know, he really plunged himself into it, and that was.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Yeah. No one, of course.
Well, Jaffe and the other, they didn't know those things.
They're
you know.
Young.
Yeah, they're
they
younger.
They came in when he retired.
That's
they
right.
They came in
that's
63, right. the sort of next wave.
That's right. That's right.
So that was.
Yeah, and this is something we my brother and sister and I still don't understand this, and we would like to.
Yes,
we just,
certainly. Yeah. So, okay. You think that the psychoanalysis, his sort of intellectual affinity with psychoanalysis was somehow not his own. I mean, he was influenced in that direction.
Well, yeah.
When I've read Freud.
It's very hard to understand it because he didn't really think that much of psychoanalysis.
Yes,
I mean, you know,
that's
he really
evident.
Didn't. Yeah, he
yeah.
didn't. So why he would go into practice in town, I can't imagine, unless he was under extreme pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that my mother always, she didn't really like Narco, and because she felt isolated, and she was mm-hmm. isolated. In those mm-hmm. days, it was considered way out in the country. Mm-hmm. And she would have rather been in town, and I think. And she may have wanted him very much just to move in town and let us have a more normal life.
Yes. So you think that it was more those kinds of concerns that steered him towards
yeah.
psychoanalysis
yeah.
rather than an interest? Would
yeah,
he have
yeah.
read Freud?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. He read everything. Yeah.
So he yeah. just because he was intellectually voracious.
Right.
Okay.
Right, right.
How did a C student,
yeah.
How did he, I mean, was he young, so young when he went to college?
Yeah,
he was just
really
sort
young.
Of forming his
That's
his
right.
ideas.
He was only 14 or something.
And so he came to being such a voracious intellectual sort
yeah.
of later.
That's right. He was. And don't forget, you know, coming from the kind of background I did where they didn't speak English and they didn't have any idea what education meant or higher education or anything. They just knew it was important that their son should be a doctor and should go to Columbia. And,
yes.
you know, so right. he had to really find his own way. He had no mentors whatsoever.
Right.
At least
right.
none from his own social world.
Yeah. It's very interesting uh-huh. because of what, I mean, psychoanalysis at Columbia.
Hmm.
I mean, there is a dominant psychoanalytic paradigm that's under dispute, and it's a lot of recent immigrants, and it's very concerned mm-hmm. with drug addiction at that point. Drug addiction is, mm-hmm. you know, but that is sort of somewhat completely apart, I would say, from how your father came to it.
Yeah, because he didn't study psychoanalysis
yeah.
at Columbia.
Yeah,
he, right. you know, he was just college there, and
so he wouldn't have even known a lot of those
no,
folks.
No, nothing at all. And he didn't go to Columbia Medical School. He went
right.
to Long downstate to
yes.
Long Island College of Medicine.
Ah, right,
yeah.
right. Okay. So that's very interesting.
Yeah.
Now, let's go back to the social isolation point.
Yeah.
Many people, I don't know whether I mentioned this to you or not, but Leo Hollister, who's a pharmacologist, talked about your father's book, The Relation of Psychiatry to Pharmacology,
right.
which... he said when he first read it, he thought it was brilliant, and he said, I could not understand how this guy who is off in the middle of nowhere could have produced this
yeah.
this brilliant synthesis of the field. And so it's a that's a relatively common construction of Lexington is pretty far off the beaten path.
Mm-hmm.
Your mother and every spouse, every wife I've talked to. had, you know, difficulties sort of making
right.
a way of life
yeah.
there. So could you talk a little bit about that? Did he ever, did your father think of it as off the beaten path? Was he ever frustrated by the disconnection to the scientific mainstream?
Oh, no.
So how
no.
would he have talked about the...
No, he never would have ever... I mean, there's where the Talmudic scholar comes in. I mean, that whole tradition, you know, you just go into your little room and you read.
Yeah.
And that's what he did. And he wrote that book because he'd been asked to write a review.
Yes.
And
he overwrote.
He overwrote, exactly. That's exactly it. He was asked to write a review. He said, okay, and it became a book. And he was terrified they wouldn't like it, they wouldn't take, I mean, he always was insecure about things, and he always felt that he was afraid they wouldn't like it. And then when it became, you know, the Public Health Service wrote and congratulated him on it, he was thrilled out of his mind, and then it became, you know, sort of a keystone but he had no idea. I mean, he was just doing a review, and he just kept finding more things to put in and more, you know, seeing more connections. And I think that was really his intellectual awakening, was doing that.
Yes.
Because he really didn't set out to write that book. He set out to write a review.
Yeah. So it's an absolutely remarkable book, I think. I mean, as I look at it, it does my job for me in a way, because he's able to kind of, he does make connections that others would not have made.
Yeah.
And so do you think he clearly wasn't formed as a disciplinary. He didn't have an affiliation to a discipline.
No, he didn't.
It's almost as if he has enough disaffiliations that he's able to kind of make a synthetic. It's a very synthetic book. It brings together.
There's something, this may sound weird, so maybe this should be off the record just because it's half-assed, is a better way to put it. But I've come to believe there's something like a synthetic mind.
Yes.
Because my brother and both sisters and I all have exactly the same kind of mind. And it's amazing. We're in four completely different fields. Mm-hmm. And yet we do exactly the same kind of thing. And what we do, all of us, is pull together things that nobody, you know, make connections between. We bring people together. We bring ideas together. We go off in directions that people think have nothing to do with what we have any basis to be doing anything about, don't know anything about, but yet we see things there.
Yes.
And we all do it. And so I've said, we've all agreed now. I've said, you know, this is where we got this from Dad. I mean, he had that ability. He also had the ability, which we don't have, is to really go deeply into things and make discoveries. And we consider ourselves sort of like superficial compared to him. But if that synthetic mind, it's very, really, we all have it. And
okay. All right. So let's.
I think he's born with it. Whatever.
To give me something on the record.
Okay. Now we'll go back.
Let's kind of characterize the nature of that. How would you characterize the nature of the work that he does? Like, say just in that book, right? Relative to that kind of claim that there is.
Well, I mean, vast reading in many different fields, and then in his particular case, the ability to understand what they did and to critique it. I mean, that was amazing, you know, because those things are not easy reading. And to be able to see, understand the methodology, understand, you know, how well they've handled it, its relevance to something else, make those connections. I mean, that's where all this zapping, you know, really is taking place.
Yes.
But probably that woke him up. Maybe that gave, in the sense of he giving him the confidence that this is the kind of thing he could do. And of course, a lot of he was doing his own research too, which informed all that, because he understood what they were doing, how they were doing it.
Right. Okay. So now let's go back to Narco and talk about when he's doing his own research, right? So when he returns in 1950.
Yeah, and he'd only got a year and a half or something.
He gets back into this program.
Right.
At that point, what's his day like? What's a typical
day that as I remember it, you know, he'd get up early and put on his uniform, because they wore uniforms, and walk to work. And I don't think they came back for lunch in those days. I think they ate in the canteen, and then he would come back late in the day, and that was his day, as far as I know. You know, I wasn't there what he was doing.
The coffee hour is somewhat legendary.
Over in the ARC?
Yeah.
I've never heard about it.
It's and they always talk about him and his.
What he's doing? Yeah. Tell me.
Well, I think that they talked a lot about research design.
Yeah.
And this is when there's a sort of influx of younger people.
Mm-hmm.
So this is somewhat later. And also, did he hang around even after he was at UK? Did he come?
Oh,
back?
He was back and forth.
Yeah.
And he gave seminars and things out there.
Yes, and the seminars are also quite legendary. But I think that the casual sort of coffee break time was actually really, really important. And people talk about his presence and talk. People, he would sometimes say things that were pretty, I mean, was he, he wasn't always tactful.
No. I just remember one of my, one time, this was at home, when he was never tactful, and one of my sister's friends had been studying voice, and she was giving a concert, and she came to, and my mother said, would you sing to what you're going to sing? And she starts to sing, and a few minutes later, from my father's office, he yells, what's that racket? Stop that racket! Poor girl's burst into tears. Horrible, but no, he was always like that. He was totally blunt and tact was, he didn't know about tact.
Yes, yeah.
But he was kind. I mean, he could be very, very kind. Mm-hmm. You know, he wasn't mean. He was just tactless.
No, people know. Are very affectionate about,
yeah,
about the tactless. It's interesting. Okay, so what did he think of his, the people who preceded him? I mean, if he, did, was Clifton Himmelsbach around?
Oh, yeah, I remember him.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so what do you remember about him, and what do you remember about their relationship?
I don't remember much about him because I was very, very small, but I do remember them in and out of the house and being, you know, they were, this was always, it was really like a family, as mm-hmm. you said, and that meant that people were in and out all the time, and I never heard anything negative about him, and, mm-hmm. you know, I would have heard. I mean, they talked openly about everybody.
He and his wife were there.
Yeah.
And
I don't remember her, I just remember him.
Right, okay. And so what about the work? I mean, anything about...
I don't know.
The okay, and what about... did you call them the Cobbs? Lawrence Cobb?
Yeah. Oh. No, I didn't know them.
Didn't know them. They
no,
were already
no,
gone.
No, they were gone.
Okay.
Right.
Right. And again, no, nothing that you remember around sort of the remarks about the work or casual...
No, I don't. I mean, because, you know, Cobb and had started the research unit, and my father moved into that, and I think it changed over time, and mainly under my father's influence, but when he went into it, he was a junior person.
Yes.
And learning things, so I think he had great respect for all of them.
Yeah, so I mean, there is a way that some people have told the story of your father's work in Isabel as in a... Some people say that, you know, Cobb's classification mm-hmm. was reinforced by their work. Other people say, well, it was really upturned mm-hmm, by their
mm-hmm.
work.
Mm-hmm.
But you didn't have a sense that there was any kind of deliberate or intentional relationship with
No, I don't think there was. I don't think so. I don't think they were looking to prove it or disprove it or anything like that.
Yes.
No,
so it was kind of, it was, they used it.
Yeah.
The sort of psychopathy and the sort of ways that they talked about the classification system.
Yeah.
It was just sort of part of the diagnostic system.
Exactly. And don't forget, that was more used in the clinical setting than it was in the research.
Yeah. And there was considerable separation, would you say?
In a sense, there was. I mean, by the time that Jaffe got there, he found it total.
You
know, he came to be with Dad, and he was put into the clinical.
Yeah, Herb Kleber as well.
Yeah.
You know, that's right.
Right. So by then it was, but I think in the earlier days it was less. And don't forget that Jaffe and Kleber and those people, they never lived out there.
Right.
And the people who lived there were both the clinical and the administrative too, you know, and research. And they were mixing all the time.
Yeah. What, do you know Conan Konecki?
Yeah, but vaguely.
Him?
Yeah.
Because he describes living there.
Yeah.
And he similarly describes a highly mixed sort of setting.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, everybody, you know, as I said, they had the cocktail parties all the time, and the parents were, you know, were always socializing. And it was completely safe. It was a bucolic, sort of beautiful place fenced in, and the kids roamed totally free. We had no supervision whatsoever, you know, and except, you know, mealtime, you had to be in, but that was it. And the, you know, the wives seemed to get along more or less. And
what did they do? Did they?
They played bridge. Yeah,
yeah,
that's all they did.
Yeah.
And but in those days, housework was a little more demanding than nowadays. I mean, you know, the washing machine was, it was electric, but you had to put things through the wringer and the, you know, hang it out. And they did. Everybody had all these servants.
Yes. From the facility.
Yeah. Who were? I have another story I'll show you, which will be off the record.
Okay.
But,
yeah, I do want to try to get at the social order of the place, of the institutions.
Well, it, you know, I could only had a child's view of it.
Yeah.
But from our point of view as kids, you know, the medical officer in charge had this big house up on the hill, and it was really gorgeous. And so that was, he was clearly highest in the pecking order. And then we could tell who was who from the stripes, number of stripes on their sleeves, because they were in the public health service, which was under the Coast Guard. So they had these stripes. And I remember being very concerned because my father had three and not four. And he, you know, explained to me he didn't want four because that would mean that he had to do all the administrating and, you know, administering, and he didn't want to. So there was that kind of rank pecking order, but I don't think it made much difference. And, it was hard to, it was hard for me to judge because my mother was so, she felt out of place very much.
Yes.
Both because she was Jewish and because she was so radical. And so she never discussed religion or politics with anybody, but she still didn't fit in terribly well.
Yes.
And so she was uncomfortable. And so I got, you know, all my perceptions came through her. And so I, it was in her view, all these, you know, cheerful Gentiles drinking their cocktails at night and then her separate from that.
Yeah. And, yes. There would be occasional Jewish researchers.
Yes.
Who do you remember?
Kroll.
Yeah.
Was one, and who else?
Was Peter Mansky there?
Who
went? Peter Mansky.
I don't remember him.
He, I think he was later.
Yeah.
He's famed for having pulled the lights out of a Christmas tree.
At some event, or it's
He lives in Albany. I want to track him down.
You should. Yeah, that's great.
But, you know, it's funny. From some of my earlier interviews, I got a sense that there was a, you know, that there was a sort of critical mass of Jewish people there, but not really. I mean,
well, there was, but there was at some times, I think later. And those were the people, the younger ones, like Jaffe.
Yeah.
And I don't know about Kleber, but I presume. And Jastinsky. And these came in, and they, but they didn't live out there. So.
Yeah.
We were the only ones who lived there,
right.
And, except for the Krolls.
Right. And and what about, okay, so let's talk now about relationship with Harris Isbell and what that was like.
Yeah.
And, well, okay, let's do Isbell and Fraser.
Okay.
And Martin.
Okay, all right. So with Isbell and Dad were very, very close. And, you know, I know had the absolutely unbounded respect for each other. Mm-hmm. And he was, we called him Uncle Harris. I mean, he was really part of the family. And but I don't know, you know, when it came to working in the lab, you know, exactly how they decided that Harris would be the head of everything, and you know what that meant in terms of what my father had to do and so on. But I know they did a lot, as you'll see when I give you the collected papers.
Yeah.
You'll see they did enormous amounts of that research together.
Yeah.
So I mean, Harris being the director didn't mean he had to spend all his time doing that kind of stuff. And they were both research scientists. They both worked together.
Right. But
and
Harris
Fraser
did
too.
Much more of the sort of relating to Washington.
Yeah, he had to be the point person for all that.
Mm-hmm. And later, Martin does that.
Yeah. Well, okay. Martin became the head of the ARC.
Right. So, I mean, there are also many stories about Martin telling other people, oh, no, you don't want to do that kind of work. You don't want to do administrative work. Sort of discouraging them from it, you know, before they become sort of in charge of things. So that they have the freedom to pursue their research.
Yeah. And maybe to keep some things hidden.
Yes.
You know, because there were CIA connections. There were things that maybe Martin Isbell didn't want people to even know about.
Yes, right.
And,
when do you think those began? I mean, do you have a sense of, and what did your father think of that?
Well, he wouldn't talk about it. So I asked him, he wouldn't talk about it.
So he never did.
He never talked about it. But I got Isbell to talk about it. Oh, I should give you my raw transcript.
Oh, I was going to ask you for that.
Yeah. Because I just have little bits, but I'll give you the whole thing.
I
mean, I edited a little bit just because Isbell at that time was half deaf and was wandering. So he would say something and then come back to it 20 minutes later. So I made it a little more coherent.
Yes.
But it's really interesting. And I'll give you that.
Yeah.
So I think that was in the late 50s, maybe. Mm-hmm. It's not clear. I only asked him about the LSD stuff. Mm-hmm. And so that would have been about the time LSD was invented in Switzerland, whenever that was.
Yeah, or 54.
Yeah, somewhere around there. And so then it was sent to them to test out. But there may have been more CIA connection. My brother's really interested in this, and he's trying to dig out.
So do you think he's found anything earlier than that?
He hasn't, but he's trying to see what else
there is. You know who's a good... I should talk to him. I think the person who now knows... Lewis Harris. Do you remember his name?
Yes.
He probably knows the most at this point. And I have some from him, but I would definitely go back. If I were more interested in the intelligence stuff, and in that aspect of the program, I would go back and talk to him. That's where I would
tell
start.
Dan. Where is he?
He's at Virginia Commonwealth at the other site, the sort of Everett Mays kind of group. They did more of the sort of pharmacology stuff, but they did a lot on incapacitating agents.
Is it Lewis L-O-U or L-E-W?
I-S.
L-O-U.
L-O-U,
Lewis Harris.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll see Dan. He's trying very hard to find things.
I would love to talk to him because I feel like I know some of... I know some of this stuff, but, you know, again, I felt like it was such a closed field. You know, the Macy Foundation records would be another good place to look, but they're closed. And they're closed to a certain point in this century. I forget what the exact date is, but they were, you know, and they funded a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
There was military stuff, but then there was also this private, you know. So you don't know what he thought of that program, not even.
Complete stonewall. I asked him if he knew about it. Stonewall, you know, just not talking about that. So, I don't have any idea.
Yeah, but I'm surprised Isbell talked. I mean, maybe to you.
He talked to me, and he didn't know that. I mean, he was. Maybe I was a little unfair because he didn't sign any informed consent thing. Yeah. You know, we just did this in my mother's apartment, and he knew I was taping it.
Yeah,
and he said everything he said freely. You know, but he said, I guess he asked me why I wanted to know, and I said, sometime I'm going to write about it. I recorded that a long time ago, you know. Mm-hmm. And I said, I wanted to write about it someday, and, you know, no problem. But
I would love to see that. Okay, so let's see. I guess we should go back to... is there more to say about your father's relationship with Isbell or the?
Not that I can say. Yeah. Now you might want to talk to Ann Isbell.
Yeah, I would.
She's great. She's in California now, and she's a little younger than I am, and I don't know. I never showed her the narco brat thing either, mainly because she's. I was afraid she'd judge my mother, but I'm sure she has some interesting memories and may not be quite the things you're looking for, but she would have things.
Right, right. And what kind of field is she in?
She had a store for a while. She's sort of a lady of upper class leisure.
Okay. So
she had a horse farm. She had,
didn't associate with addicts.
No.
Okay. And what about what about Martin? Martin comes in.
Martin came in later, and it was Isbell that hired him when he was leaving, you know, to go to UK.
Yeah.
Or maybe before. Actually, Isbell left, I think, a little before my father and went back to Texas where he had grown up. And then he decided to come back. And so he came back to Lexington.
Right. So Martin and your father have only a brief 5 years or so?
Yeah, overlap. I think so, yeah. But, you know, my father thought the world of Martin. Just absolutely, he was thrilled that Martin was the person brought in. Just really adored him.
And Fraser's sort of...
Fraser's always been a mysterious figure to me.
Yeah,
I never could figure him out. And But they all said he was very smart, and they liked his work, you know, and he was, it was a trio, Fraser, Isabel, and Whittler, and they worked together. I never could figure them out. I mean, it just, they lived out there for a while, but they lived in an apartment in the main building, which there were a couple. And so they weren't out there frolicking around. The kids weren't in the same way. I mean, they would come out, but it was, you know, it just wasn't quite the same. And the Dorothy Fraser was a the only one of those women that I remember as always having her hair perfect, dyed blonde, always and just exactly right, and a lot of makeup on, and always a big smile, so the kind of smile, you know, which I always took as hypocrisy, because that's what. And they just seemed odd to me.
Yeah, so they didn't, and he goes to pharmaceutical industry at the end. So,
yeah, which didn't surprise me a bit,
Yeah, interesting.
And of their three kids, the oldest one, Bob, just died 2 weeks ago. So I had a long talk with Ann Isbell just the other day about him, and she knew very much better than I did. I'd lost touch with him.
All right, so he's, I'm struck actually by the story that you told about Isabel and Fraser, in a sense, making sure that your father's resignation doesn't go through.
Yeah, isn't that something?
So that they're able to bring him back. They must have had substantial faith in him at that point. They've seen him try to do this other thing, and they've...
They may have been opposed to it. I don't know. I mean, the three of them were very, really quite close. There was a later period where Fraser had a really bizarre episode where he'd been taking medication for something. I don't know, blood pressure. I'm not really sure what it was. But he went into this maniacal phase of hand washing and being terrified of germs. And he started barricading himself in his office for fear that something was going to come get him. And, you know, so I remember then Dad and Isabel decided that, you know, something had gone wacky with his medications. And so they, being biological, psychiatrists as they were, and so they had him hospitalized and get him off of whatever he was doing. And they, you know, and then he was fine after that. But you know, they all were there for each other all the time. This was much later than my father's, but they.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Yes. None of those kinds of stories have ever come to light in my interviews. Mm. I mean, mostly because these are younger,
they don't know those things. Sure.
They don't know this.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's see. I wanted to, there was something that was just haunting me, and I'm not.
Do you want a little more coffee?
Better not.
Okay.
Better not. Speaking of medications.
Yeah, I've had more than I should, but I have a little more.
Yeah, okay. Oh, I know. I wanted to return to the Pavlovian work, because I mean, clearly that's something that I would credit your father with doing. You know, really sort of saying, okay, we should look at this way of thinking about the phenomenon.
Yeah.
What do you think gets him to do that? Why does he become interested in conditioning?
Well, he never told me that, but in that book, you have that book on public health service, the anniversary book.
Yes.
He described in there that when he was on the ward, when he first came there, he noticed that the responses or the anguish of the people going through the withdrawal varied according to whether he was there or he wasn't there.
Yes.
And that sort of ticked him off that there's something going on here, and that has to do with his presence, and that made him thinking then what would be a mechanism. I don't think he thought they were faking it, but that their anguish was greater meant that some way he was triggering something in them, and so he began thinking about the conditioning. And that, of course, was a many-year study. I mean, he didn't know Pavlov's work very well, as far as I know. And he then, after he got into this, they sent him for a year of training. And I remember we were in Chicago, we were in New Haven. So it was a year in which he worked with different people and then came back.
When was that?
Oh, that was very early on. So that was, let's see, I was three.
Before the psychoanalysis.
Yeah.
And do we know where?
Where we went?
Yeah.
I only remember Chicago because I remember going to nursery school there, and that he would take me up in this elevator, so to nursery school. And then I know just because I've been told that we were in New Haven. I think it was in two or three different places for several months each. Mm-hmm. And in New Haven, I think it was, or maybe it was Chicago. He worked with Jules Masterman, mm-hmm. Who was, I think, an analyst, mm-hmm. but also interesting. And he stayed close to Masterman always. I mean, not, I don't know how very close, but they were in touch. And I remember when I went to the University of Chicago, my father came up and took me to a cocktail party at the Masterman's mm-hmm. house. So I know him. Mm-hmm. The Masterman later got into big, you know, scandals and stuff.
And they decide, who decided that he should be sent, where he should
My guess is he decided.
That he sort of put it together and said, yeah. in order for me to pursue this
these are
possibility, mm-hmm. then I need to go to these places.
Yeah.
And when
I'm guessing, that's just a guess.
When did he travel to
Russia? Soviet yeah, later. That was later. That was much later.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. When?
Yeah. You didn't go there. They never went anywhere until about late 50s, I think. I don't think they ever went abroad. He had a sabbatical year, mm-hmm. sort of, and they went to many different places. I'm not even sure they went to Russia at that time. They were in Italy for a while. They were traveling around because they put Dan and Jean in a boarding school in Switzerland, and I was in college, so I didn't go. Norma went to Paris.
Oh, so that was a lot.
It was much later, yeah. But that was the first year that they ever really had any long stints abroad.
Yeah.
I don't think he was in Russia until then.
Oh, okay. All right. So there was not so he learned the Pavlovian approaches in this country
right.
during this year.
He began there, and then he studied on his own.
And what about behaviorism? Skinnerian? I mean, do you remember any?
No, but my brother would be able to tell you about that because. Okay. He had some talks with my father about it, I remember. He has written a strange little essay about his conflict with my father over that. You have to talk to him because I don't want to speak for him. It's just, but no, he could tell you about that.
Okay, that'd be great. Yeah. Did you send him my chapters?
No, because he just got back. He was in China.
That's
so,
right.
But
okay.
He wants them. He told me. I told him I'll send them. And he
all
wants
right.
Them.
Well, so I'll want to talk to him about that and also about Lewis Harris.
Yeah, tell him. You tell him about that. That'd be good. Yeah.
Incapacitating agents.
Oh, God.
I mean, it's kind of hard to imagine LSD being used in a systematic way.
Well, there's that horrible letter, you know, that Isabel wrote about stuffing it into somebody. But I found the paper where they, do I have that paper? Yeah, I have that paper where they gave it to somebody for 40 days.
I don't know how they make sense of what they were doing at that. I don't know how to make sense of what they were doing, and I don't know how they made sense of what they were doing. But sort of certainly in the normal course of things, that made sense to them. I mean,
well, you know what's interesting? I think that's the one. Is it the one? It's the one. They wrote a paper on it. After my father died, my mother had all his papers collected, and they were just using the reprints, so they're just sort of like
that's
bound together.
Wonderful.
Yeah, and so a set went to UK. A set, she may still have, I don't know, and I have a set. Mm-hmm. I think that's it. And when I got interested in figuring out about this LSD, I knew they had written paper, and I went looking for this, and it's not there. It's the only one of his papers that's not there. So I got it through interlibrary loan, and I put it in there myself. But, you know, that he didn't have that, that wasn't available, that's really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I really wonder what he would have thought, given his politics and given his own sort of sense of himself. What he would have thought of that kind of research, and particularly what he would have thought about working for the CIA or the Army. I mean, it was an Army program, the Incapacitating Agents program.
He had nothing but contempt for the CIA.
Yeah.
I mean, he was totally opposed to the CIA.
So
it's very... Yeah, and I don't know whether he just felt, well, you know, this is what he has to do because that's part of his job. Or I've argued my brother a lot because he feels that it's possible dad was more involved than I think he was. Mm-hmm. But the reason, one reason I think he wasn't is because there is that letter from Isbell to somebody saying, please get some other people around here some security clearance because I don't like being the only one mm-hmm. to know these things. So that makes me think, well, dad didn't have security clearance, so he couldn't have been very deeply involved.
I don't think he was that deeply involved because yeah. he did not go, like these MACI conferences on neuropharmacology mm-hmm. and also the LSD conferences mm-hmm. where Abramson and Kornetsky did LSD research then. He went to all of those. Uh-huh. Your father did not. And you know, Isbell did. And, you know, there's just no presence in those. Mm. And they were sort of half clandestine, half not.
Yeah.
You know, there are okay. transcripts of them. Mm. They're, so there's sort of parts of them are available, parts of them are not. And I don't know, it'd be interesting to talk to Marks, who did the search for the mentoring candidate.
Oh, yes.
John Marks, he writes somewhat about that.
Right.
I'm a little, you know, it's a little paranoid, some of the things.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
But, you know, clearly, I think if your father had been more involved, he would have been included in those kinds of discussions.
Right.
And he wasn't.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure he wasn't interested.
Yeah.
I'm sure of that.
I mean, my guess is he had a... I mean, that there was some conflict between him and them about that, though it doesn't show up.
Right. And he never said a word.
Right. And when Isbell, you know, testified about that work, he doesn't, you know, he's very careful about what he says, and obviously in the testimony before Congress in the 70s.
Yeah. It's just not like my father. I mean, he was so obsessed with his own work. Mm-hmm. He was really passionate about it, and that he would have taken the time to be doing this other stuff if he didn't. And to any more extent than he absolutely had to, just doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah. And okay, so let's go back to him now and talk about what, when you say that he was obsessed with his own work, mm-hmm. what do you think he saw as his work, right? I mean, you've talked a number of times about, you know, his passions. You know, what do you think that he thought he was sort of on the trail of?
As far as I can tell, it was really elucidating the mechanisms of addiction. Mm-hmm. And that's as far as I know. And this is, of course, the days before the opiate receptor and the other things.
Yes.
So he was working wasn't working on the molecular level and wasn't really thinking on that. And I don't know that he could have because that wasn't he wasn't a molecular biologist. But in terms of understanding it through some sophisticated form of the conditioning theory, I think that's basically what mm-hmm. what he was trying to do, but it was a lifetime job.
Martin had a mm-hmm. hypothesis about the multiplicity of opiate receptors mm-hmm. Before they were visualized, and clearly they talked about things at that mm-hmm. level.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me because Martin is figuring that out through clinical observation. It sounds crazy, but he was not working. He was putting that hypothesis together based upon his observation, and so it's, you know, I don't know.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, it is. It is really an interesting story. And one of the reasons that I think Lexington represented a kind of loss. Was because who could do that now? Nobody who works at the molecular level sees. I mean, they may have them in for PET scans or something like that,
right.
but they don't. They could not make those kinds of observations.
Well, one thing I found so fascinating in your work there, in the chapters you sent me, was the idea not really put it together that, of course, this was one time and place where all these people were there at the same time. I mean, the researchers down in the dungeon of the laboratory still had contact with the patients. Everybody was mixed in with everybody else. And now everybody, I had not realized the extent to which now all this is specialized so that people working in addiction research don't work with addicts and so on.
Yes.
And I hadn't realized it, but of course it's true.
Yeah. Yeah. So what about the social mixing aspects? Clearly your father went from being somebody who was sort of naive about addicts. I mean, someone mm-hmm. who didn't know much about mm-hmm. them to someone who knew a great deal. Mm-hmm. That meant that he did have... do you have a sense of what he thought in sort of social terms about the social problem of addiction?
Well, the conditioning theory is basically a social theory. I mean, it really is saying that the social conditions are the things that trigger at least the relapses, and that mm-hmm. one is conditioned to it through a social conditioning. So that I think that for him it was inextricable. Mm-hmm. I mean, what actually happens, the mechanism of how conditioning works and what is it that's happening in your brain or where nervous system that makes you respond to those things, that's the scientific problem. But the fact that those triggers exist have the effect means that it's a social thing.
Right.
So for him, these problems were all, there was psychological, sociological,
yes,
biological.
Yes. Later, it's pretty clear that there were tensions at Lexington around sociology. Do you think he had any kind of sense of either, you know, tension or consonance with sociology?
This is off the record. This is where his Not Suffering Fools comes in. He didn't have anything against sociology per se, but he had a lot against all the sociologists he ever met. Mm-hmm. Thought they were idiots. Mm-hmm. John Ball included. That's why this is off the record.
Yeah.
And so that was the tension. It wasn't over sociology or sociological approach. It was over the individuals who were doing it.
Yes. Yes.
I'll go back on Rick.
Okay. All right. Well, let's see. I am interested in this because, you know, at some point, I mean, they even form a unit, a sort of sociological unit, and they're pursuing this kind of research. Obviously, there's tension. How to talk about it is hard to know. But, so I don't know if you have anything you want to say on the record.
No. I think my father was very suspicious of skeptical of any kind of research that didn't look at underlying mechanisms. I mean, this is maybe a slightly different thing I'm going to tell you now, not quite what they were doing there, but he used to tell me a story of sociologists of science who would, you know, go into a scientific gathering, you know, group of people sitting around a table who are discussing scientific ideas and sociologists not understanding the ideas at all.
Yeah.
And would see how the group interacted and would note the dynamics and who was the leader and who's this.
Right.
You know, and totally not understanding that they were talking about ideas and it was the ideas that were of the person that were what they was generating, who was the leader and so on, and completely misunderstand everything that was being seen because not understanding what was the issue there and what they were talking about.
Right.
And this is, I think, the way he felt a lot of sociologists were working. That's not to say that sociology at NARCO necessarily had to be grounded in the biology of NARCO. Depends on what they were studying, but he still felt that they were superficial.
Yes. You know? Okay, so it was a... superficial. That would be a way to put it.
Yeah.
Who do you think he was talking about, or what kind of sociological?
Well, I'm not sure.
Kind of sociology of science that he had run into.
I don't know. I have no idea. I mean, he may have been talking more generally about about that, and not about the particular people that he was seeing there. But he was talking about the general enterprise, I think, of sociology of science. Now, that may not be the same thing as this.
But what would there have been in his environment at that point?
Well, I don't know. And I don't know, you know, how much, if he, I guess he had left by the time that crazy experiment Matrix House was
yeah, done. He would have,
he was gone by then. Right. So that was really
You know who he could have run into in night, except it was bad timing, Lindisman.
He had nothing but contempt for Lindisman. Absolutely nothing but contempt.
He goes there in 1949. He's a consultant.
Yeah.
In 1949, which is, that's what I'm saying. It's bad timing because...
You know, Lindisman's people, Lindisman's not alive anywhere, is he?
No.
No. But his people haven't changed a bit. And when we had that symposium here at Smith and I invited Jaffe, I got letters from them, you know, saying I should never have invited him, that he's the biggest... because he still thinks that this is a biological problem. And
Jaffe.
Yeah. I got the attacking me for inviting Jerry Jaffe to speak at Smith.
From
the Lindesmith Foundation.
Really?
Yes. And their argument was that, you know, here, this is somebody whose number one, you know, crime is to claim that this is a biological problem and it's really just society that's sick and, you know, giving the whole business. It was really...
Still.
Yeah.
From, like, Ethan...
I've forgotten who sent it to me. It was... But that was...
Wow.
Unless I'm No, I'm sure that's it was. And it was fascinating.
I mean, it's really interesting to me because Linda Smith... Really interesting. I have to deal with this because one of my chapters, I mean, obviously there are tensions around, you know, biological, behavioral, and sociological. But, boy, you know, they all had the same enemies. You know, so
but then they had each other.
Yeah. You know, I mean, Harry Anslinger didn't, like, I mean, hounded Linda Smith.
Yeah.
You know, for
oh
decades.
Yeah, sure he would. Yeah, they all hated Anslinger, but they thought he was just a sort of, you know, a tough guy thug. And
yeah. So something is interesting and going on about sociology. You know, Jasinski told me, he said something like, "Oh yeah, you know, there was a paradigm, a sociological paradigm. You know, they were all Marxists." He said.
Who?
Sociologists.
Oh, they may have been. Yeah.
At Narco. And he sort of constructed it as if they were running the show. Like, you know, so different from my sense of, you know, who was running the show and what was, you know, was sort of, but, yeah, well.
I don't think Ball was not a Marxist.
I can't think of any of them who would actually.
I don't know the others, I just knew Ball could.
Characterized in those terms. So this is very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, anybody else who, I mean, not that I want you to sort of produce his list of people he had contempt for, but anybody else with whom he was in clear sort of intellectual or political tension?
Of names. Let's see.
Or fields.
Well, you know, he thought, again, it really had to do with the quality of the work.
Yeah.
I mean, I used to think that he thought all psychology was idiotic. But then I found out, no, there were some psychologists for whom he had respect.
Mm-hmm.
Stanley Milgram was one that he respected, although I don't think he knew him, but he just respected his work because he felt it was solid.
Mm-hmm.
If he felt that there were either any sloppy thinking going on or sloppy methodology, he was scathing.
Yes, and do you think that has to do with experimental research design and...
No, I think he was just, it was his personality. I don't think it had anything to do with anything else.
Okay, so it was not about, you know, is this a randomized or is this a controlled experiment? Or?
Well, I mean, he would see right through, you know, to be able to see in most things, that's how he was able to write their review, to see how they did it and whether they had done it well and so on. But most of what I heard him be scathing about was idiots, people, you know.
Right, individuals.
Yeah individuals. You know, he's very similar to Jerry Jaffe, if you've talked to Jerry.
Yeah,
and they both, I don't think Jerry's much more politic. You know, he knows how to do it. He's been in Washington a long time and stuff.
Yeah.
But they have that same kind of really keen and very unconventional mind.
Yeah.
And they don't put up with, they don't let you get away with any nonsense at all.
Yeah, I haven't interviewed Jerry yet, because you see, he's been interviewing everybody else.
Jerry has?
Yeah.
There are
all of these books now, and I found out he's the sort of blind interviewer.
Interesting.
They're called Addiction. Griffith Edwards, the Journal of the Addictions, decided to begin doing oral histories. And Jerry Jaffe has done a lot of them.
Oh, that's interesting.
But, you know, it's not clear. I mean, sometimes it says who's the interviewer, but it's not, you know, not when they come out. And so, you know, and they're very interesting.
Yeah, he would make them interesting because he knows everyone and he knows everything, and he'd be able to ask questions that no one else would think of. You know?
And so therefore, I'm intimidated and I'm waiting to interview him until I've interviewed everybody else.
But he's delightful. Yeah,
and he also doesn't seem on the verge of demise. He seems healthy.
Oh yeah, no, he's in good shape. Yeah.
Did your father ever mention a particular field of psychodynamics?
I don't remember that.
So not differentiating. You remember it as a sort of, as, you know, psychology
with the exception of a few people who
that's right.
Queer
yeah.
thinkers with,
yeah.
within that
yeah.
within that field.
Right.
Yeah. So the way I characterized him around psychoanalysis, do you think that's right, or do you think that
Well, tell me again, remind me how you did it.
I think that I view him as somebody who was not sort of refuting psychoanalysis mm-hmm. or psychodynamics, but saw elements of those approaches that were useful to his own enterprise and sort of picked.
Yeah, I think he did. I mean, have you read Edward Wilson's book Consilience?
Yeah.
You know, came out after my father died, but I think he would have loved it because mm-hmm. For him, the meshing of all these different layers and levels is exactly what he was trying to do. And he appreciated each and every one, but he also believed that they were, in fact, linked. Mm-hmm. And this linkage was what was important.
Yes.
And so for him, psychoanalysis, insofar as it was one level that could be tied to others, would be important, but thinking of it just in talk therapy, for example, whatever, in and of itself, would not, but only insofar as it actually was working in conjunction with some mechanism.
Yeah.
One of his favorite, he had a cartoon on the wall of his office, which showed a psychiatrist in his office, and with all the diplomas on the wall, the psychiatrist is looking at a patient who's sitting across the table, not on a couch, and he says, "Now tell me more about this nagging backache." And we, the cartoon audience, see the guy has a knife in his back. The psychiatrist can't see that, and he only sees the face. "Now tell me more about this nagging backache." Nagging
That's
backache
great.
In quotes, you know.
Right.
And that was his favorite cartoon, and that really says.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very, very interesting the way you put it. Many behavioral pharmacologists who believe that they are social. Triggers, etc. There are a lot of people in this field who will make arguments that against reductionism, right? So they'll say, "Yeah, I believe that there's a lot that pharmacology can contribute, but we'll never understand it this way. There are so many layers to this phenomenon." And they're, in fact, quite critical of new neuroscientific paradigms mm-hmm. because they think they're too reductionist. And they think that, that kind of work will never fully explain a complex social and biological phenomenon like right. addiction. And it sounds to me like your father would have been made a similar kind of argument.
No, I don't think so. I think that he... I think, he died before we could talk about this kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, but certainly it seems to me, and I would strongly suspect he would agree with me completely, is that we may not ever really understand, we can't reduce psychology to biology to physics, because there are emergent phenomena at certain levels of complexity.
Yes.
And that's the reason you can't do it, but that you can't really understand one level if you don't have a grounding in the other and appreciate the other. And the same thing for the levels above, so that they're all intermeshed. And mm-hmm. it's silly to go either extreme to say, well, it's just all atomic physics, so what are we, that's where it's at, or to say we'll never understand this. It's almost dualism,
Mm-hmm.
And so I think both of those extremes are wrong, and it's somewhere in the middle. And you have to work in one level. You can't be doing everything. But at the same time, you should be aware and be connected with and keeping.
Yes, yes. When did he die?
81.
And had he retired by
then? Just barely, just a year or two.
From UK?
Yeah.
And do you remember... was there a retirement party?
I have a tape of it's an interesting tape. I have a tape of, there was a retirement symposium. I guess, I think that, not at UK, that may have been from NARCO. Anyway, somewhere in there. And Jerry speaks, and...
Really?
Yeah.
Could I listen to
that? Yeah.
I would love to. Wow.
Yeah, and actually I have a tape also of the memorial service, after he died. which people spoke about him in different capacities. It's interesting, too.
Yes. If I could listen to those, I would.
I'll make copies for you. I'll find them, and then you can have them there.
That would be wonderful.
And the retirement, it's funny. I mean, he adored Jaffe, and he tells his story, which he told many times, of how he would give a seminar out at NARCO. I think this is even after he was at UK. He would go out and give Saturday seminars, and all these guys were there. You've heard this story?
No, I was just thinking, one of my questions is about heir apparents, whether there were,
Jaffe,
whether
absolutely
he had.
Jaffe, and Martin, too, but those two. But with the Jaffe story, it's funnier when you hear him tell it, but I'll tell you anyway. But he said that he would go out there, and there were all these residents sitting there at the seminar, and he said they all fell asleep. You know, he said 10 minutes they were out. He said only one because they awake, and that was Jaffe. And he said, and I predicted great things for Jaffe. It's really cute. But
But
Jaffe tells, and he hasn't said this lately, but he said it then, and so it's important that we have it on tape, is that the big test of the conditioning theory was the was dealing with the Vietnam soldier. You know this. To be sure that the ones who were addicted in Vietnam, and it was Jaffe who made the decision that we're going to treat them there and not bring them back, and that was so that the conditioning response, that the triggers were there and not here, that they had nothing to associate in this country with the addiction. And so that was really, he thinks, the reason why so few returned to drug addiction when they came here, because they didn't have any any triggers, you know.
Right. Did you know Norman Zinberg?
Just the name.
Yeah.
Has he written about that?
He wrote about controlled use, and he used the Vietnam veteran example.
Yeah.
And those guys were all working together at that time.
Yeah.
Jaffe and, you know, they would have known each other.
Oh, yeah, sure. So, well, Jaffe was the drug czar at the time.
Right.
And this was his decision to do it. He said, we're going to try this out. And
So did your father, I mean, watching that, did he become more interested in drug policy at that point?
He never became interested in drug policy.
So he never thought that people at the ARC or people who knew something about drug addiction should have more presence or pull?
He might have thought that they should, but not he.
He really didn't want to.
He is the Talmudic scholar in that respect, always.
Yeah.
In that sense, absolutely. You know, just leave me alone with my books and, you know, my lab and do whatever you want.
Right. Okay. All right. So you think that the protégés were Jaffe and Martin his...
No question about it.
Okay.
I mean, no question about it insofar as I ever heard about it.
Yeah.
But I know he was proud of Kleber. He was proud of all of them. You know,
yeah.
It's delighted. I mean, he was really, it meant a lot to him to have all these young people. I mean, my brother didn't go into medicine, and that was a great disappointment to him. And so they had big fights, and my brother went into philosophy. My father thought it was a family disgrace. And if he had known that Dan would be, you know, one of the world's leading medical ethicists, I think it would have changed his mind. And, you know, I think he'd be very proud of him now, but he was very upset at the time.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk a little bit about the ethical, the sort of ethics of human subjects research. It's a big, I have to confess, I don't really know how to write about it other than what I told you in the email about, you have to understand the institutional culture. And so I've tried to understand the institutional culture of Lexington, you know, where there was pretty, it's pretty clear, almost everybody I've talked to who has been there will talk in admiring ways of addicts. Herb Kleber, for instance, will talk, you know, in very respectful ways about even the sort of level of deviousness that addicts would get. And now, again, clinical side, very much somebody who's thinking about clinical research.
Well,
not
I think
somebody who's thinking. In the
well,
term
Dad and Isabel and all of them had, I don't know if respect is quite the right word, but maybe it is for the brains of these guys. I mean, they felt they were really, really smart and very devious.
Yeah.
But that was a sign of their intelligence. I mean, they're really smart guys, and they liked some of them, and some of them they just thought were really bizarre characters, and I'm sure they were. And some of them he really didn't like. And among the ones they didn't like, I remember there was great maybe it's because of things they did later, but people like Alexander King, who went out and wrote, they said that everything he wrote was a lie, and they just really upset about that. And,
yeah. What did they, so they would have kept up with representations of Lexington?
To the extent that it came to their attention, yeah.
Do you remember the Fantastic Lodge?
No.
Janet, well.
Don't know that one.
You should read it.
Oh, okay.
Find it. You can find it used pretty easily.
Okay.
It's Janet Clark is a pseudonym of a heroin addicted woman from Chicago, white woman who it's a it's a book, tape recorded transcript that Helen McGill Hughes and Howard Becker did kind of together when Howard Becker was in grad school. And it became a popular best-selling book. The copy I have had been given by someone as a Christmas present to someone else. And it's a very interesting, she talks quite a bit about Lexington, about the sort of treatment side of it, the clinical side of it.
So I know her name, but I don't.
You'd be interested in it.
Okay, yeah. Fantastic Lodge, okay.
Yeah, or I'll find a copy for you.
Okay.
Send it. It's, yeah. So they would have kept up to some extent with publications, with the way that people represented Lexington.
Yeah, yeah.
And newspapers, journalists, reporters, I mean, were there?
I don't remember them ever talking about that, but I remember talking about the books.
Mm-hmm. Anybody besides Alexander King, if you recall?
No, I mean, we were always awash in the celebrity culture there. I mean, that was all the time. Guess who came? Guess who's here? And, you know, everybody was tickled, including the doctors, you know, that Robert Mitchum was there, or so they say. And, of course, I remember Barney Ross myself and Elmo Jones, I guess the drummer, and a whole host of famous jazz musicians. And Billie Holiday at some point was there. And, what other movie stars? Lots. And the doctors were just as tickled as everybody else. That's apropos of, but anyway, they had a good time, actually. You know, and I think they enjoyed and found interesting the mix of cultures and so on. You know, Chinese were very special, and they were treated a little bit specially because it was understood that they were picked up for doing things that in their own culture was not considered to be a particular problem. And
smoking opium.
Yeah, yeah. And a possession too. I think you couldn't be there if you didn't have. It wasn't just for use; it was for possession. But they owned it, you know, and that was what they did. And those guys were interesting.
And so you remember that as a child, you know, sort of overhearing conversations about who had come.
Yeah, yeah. And we all wanted to see them if we could. We didn't get.
And
to
did
see
you?
Them. Well,
did you go?
Barney Ross only. We saw the jazz musicians because we would go to the concerts.
Yes.
But we didn't meet them.
And these were concerts that were organized by them?
Yeah.
Or by patients themselves?
Yeah. Yeah. They had their own orchestra or band or whatever it was, but the hospital bought instruments for them. And they went out of their way, you know, to make them happy. And all the Chinese meals that they had for everybody on Chinese New Year and so on. It was really quite...
Okay, this is great. I'd love to hear about any of these kinds of recollections about the culture of the place, the sort of institutional culture.
Yeah, you know, again, I saw it mostly as a kid living out on the grounds there, but I remember the Chinese making dragon kites for us.
Hmm.
And, of course, we had, this is, again, just our own family, we had always Chinese cook.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
But the for me, very touching thing, that we had this guy, what was his name? Tong. I don't know. We had several different Chinese cooks. They all made fried rice. They loved to make fried rice. And that's what we ate every night. And egg foo young. But I loved the fried rice. It was just so good. And then as an adult, I started going to Chinese restaurants. I'd ordered fried rice. And it was horrible. And it never was. It just was such a disappointment. And then it was just 3 years ago, I guess 2.5 years ago, the first time Stan and I went to China. And I thought, let's try it. And the restaurant somewhere, I ordered fried rice. And there it was. The real fried rice, and I almost started to cry. You know, it was, and I felt so at home in China. It was amazing. You know, I just felt completely at home, and then I realized why, because I grown up with these people.
So, and they were in the house.
They were in the house. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But the ease that I felt in China, and everybody looked so familiar to me. And I've seen many Chinese, but there was just something about being there. And then that fried rice was the way it was supposed to be.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was great.
Wow. And, okay, what do you recall of blacks, of African Americans? I mean, yeah, mainly the jazz stuff.
Yeah, well, we had black houseboys also.
And what were race relations like? I mean, what was your...
I don't know. Isabel told me, and you'll see on that tape, on that transcript, that they segregated themselves to some extent, that mm-hmm. the hospital was opposed to segregation, but there was a lot of self-segregation. Mm-hmm. And I don't, you know, the one thing I think, the decision of who would work where was, as Isabel put, the penology side of narco, and he had nothing to do with that. But I do know that there were never any white houseboys.
Yeah.
They were either Chinese or black. And my guess is that this was I wouldn't say it was a racist thing so much as believing to keep the white wives safe. That was my feeling, that probably that was the reason that there would be, if you have a color line either for Asian or for black, that will not be crossed.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
if you had a white servants in the house, there might be.
So. Yeah. Were there, do you recall any scandal? I've
no.
heard one.
You
one
have.
Story.
Well,
one
who
story.
Was it?
Oh, there was a white female researcher named, who basically ran away with someone.
Huh.
And I can get her, I can dig her name out.
Oh, I'd be curious to see. I'll tell you if I remember her.
I don't, you know, that was the only, you know, thing of that nature that was ever mentioned. And of course the wives, like Chuck Gorodetsky's wife and Don Jasinski's wife, mm-hmm. You know, they swear there's no, you know, they remember her. They remembered her.
Oh, and they don't believe that story? Or
no, they do believe that story, but there's nothing else.
Nothing else.
So
yeah, I'd love to know who that was. I might remember her.
Yeah.
Marie Nicewander was the scandalous one.
Well, yeah, tell me about. Yeah.
Well, she was only there for about a year, mm-hmm. and she was a free spirit. My mother was quite frightened of her because she was so, she was clearly what in those days would be called, what, a man stealer or something like that. I forgot what they, there was no question about it. And so my mother, you know, kept her at arm's length, but I remember her quite vividly. You know, she was in our house a lot, and mm-hmm. But I hadn't known that she'd been giving out the morphine shots for Christmas until Isabel told me about that.
Yeah,
I was amazed, you know?
Quite a story.
Right. And I thought that deserved to see the light of day, so I put it in my...
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah.
But she was only there for a while, and then she left, and then she opened the methadone clinics, and they were so opposed to methadone, Dad and Isabel.
Yes.
Completely.
And what grounds?
Because they felt that it just replaced one addiction with another, and mm-hmm. which people agree today. I mean, that. But it seemed at the time better. But who did she marry? What's his name?
Vincent Dahl.
Yeah, they felt that she'd pulled the wool over his eyes, and that it was her femme fatale mode that had taken a very fine scientist and turned him into an idiot. And so
okay.
That was there.
But Jerry Jaffe.
Yeah.
And Bob Schuster ran, you know, one of the first sort of methadone programs in Illinois that was, you know, separate
know.
From what they were doing.
Yeah.
What? How did your? I mean, what did you?
I think by that time they'd gotten used to the fact that this is what was going to be. And you see that Marie was there much earlier.
Yeah. '50s.
Yeah, in the '50s, and so by the time then she died early too, fairly early. And they always thought of Dole as someone who should have known better. But they didn't feel that way toward Jerry, I think, because he was doing practical things. I mean, Jerry had a problem. He had to deal with addicts and help them. And this they realized that this did help in some sense.
Yeah.
But Dole was different because Dole was doing research.
Yeah.
And they felt Dole should know better.
Yeah.
That this is not
so it wasn't that they differed with Dole's. I mean, Dole did more like metabolic research.
Yeah. Well, they're all for that, but they just felt that this, they believed, and even in that little narco book, the anniversary thing,
yeah,
there's some snide remarks about Marie having.
Yes.
Have you noticed those? And
she's. Yeah, I'm interested in the representation of her. Also, did you know, and then Mary Jean Creek, who's very interesting. She's an interesting character. She was around. She was their research assistant, Marie and Vincent's research assistant. And she's now at Rockefeller University. And I started an interview with her, and I've got to go back to her. I don't know what to think. I really don't.
I never heard her name.
But one of the things about Jaffe, about Jaffe's methadone program, was that it was multimodal. Mm-hmm. You know, there was all this multimodal stuff that they were trying. And so it was not just methadone. And it was not, so I think there, it was trying to test, it was an experimental test, for what modalities sort of worked for whom. And so it was set up in a different way.
Well, Jerry was a pragmatist.
Yeah.
You know, he trying to solve a problem, and whatever would work, and whereas I only knew Marie when she was at Narco, and I didn't know her afterwards. I just heard them talk about her all the time, but it seemed like she was a fanatic about methadone per se, but I don't know that. But I later read a little bit about her and realized she was a free spirit. I mean, she had a very interesting background.
Yeah.
And wow. And it was the kind of person.
Did you read David Courtwright's paper on her?
No, I don't think so. I read Nat Hentoff's book, and then I read something else and some article about her.
Yeah.
But she was really an interesting person, and I can see that she would have been a total threat to my mother because she was she really was a free spirit in a most marvelous sense. You know, she didn't have any of the background constraints that hung up everybody else.
Right. Right.
And this is the uptight 50s. And 40s, where people were so concerned what other people thought, and is this the proper thing? And I know that for my mother, you know, being this in this strange situation where she is this radical and she's Jewish, but she's fanatically dying to be accepted by the local culture. And for her, you know, which fork you use first and where it goes in the place setting was of utmost importance. And so then to have Marie, who comes in, kicks off her shoes, and, you know, does whatever she feels like, was just really upsetting.
Yes. Yeah.
And especially someone who could talk to my father about the scientific work.
Yes. With his, it's interesting. I never thought about that before. You know, this sort of threat that, I mean, she is represented in doing what she did and how. I'll send you the David Courtwright paper or have him send it because it talks about her, I mean, her conversion experience where she goes from being psychoanalytic to believing, methadone. I mean, she does become a fanatic.
Yeah.
And the way that is configured around her marriage, divorce, and remarriage is also very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so he wrote actually about that, about...
Oh, I'd love to read that.
Yeah. That's another thing I will put down to send to you.
She could be a character for a novel. I mean, she would really be
yeah.
a really interesting person. I mean, there's really...
You know, he wrote... Her ex wrote a novel.
Oh, really?
Yeah. the David Core... I've got to get it.
Who is her ex?
Her ex? God, I don't...
I think she was divorced by the time she got to Lexington, wasn't she?
He wrote the Courtwright uses the novel as one of the sources because the husband goes off, the ex goes off to Europe and writes this novel to get over Marie. And so
it's all.
And it's actually about methadone. I mean, the novel is about a guy who discovers a drug. And, you know, so it's all very, it's a very many layered thing.
Yeah. It's just great. I've got a friend who writes novels and stories in which scientists are often the protagonists. And I can tell her about Marie.
Oh, yeah. Really, yeah, definitely.
Really be thinking about this. Because
it's a story that could definitely bear retelling.
Oh, absolutely.
But you got to get Mary Jean in there, Mary Jean Creek, because she's observing all this happen. It's wild. Yeah,
that's really wild. That's just so marvelous. I just
So, this is sort of extreme. It's kind of out of shape, in terms of the interview, but when you read, you've read Relation of Psychiatry to Pharmacology.
Yeah.
Do you remember?
It's been a long time.
Okay, one of the things that your father did was he put absolutely every word that could be construed as a value judgment in quotations. It's a very odd writing convention for this, scientific writing in this period. Do you remember this at all?
No, I don't. I have to look at it again. But
I'm trying to figure out why.
Because he would be questioning everything like that.
Yes.
And so that's why he would do it.
And so was that a conventional writing style for him?
No,
I mean, not in his scientific work. He doesn't do that.
Yeah, no.
But did he do any other kind of writing that...
No, he didn't. He... let me get the books. Let me show you what
okay,
I've got. This
great.
Is really all I have. Besides his two books, that one and the other, the one he did at the end of his life.
Yes.
Then I have